tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have the words green or renewable in them. But then when you dig into them more deeply, it turns out that not only are they a waste of precious time, but they actually are climate solutions that are worse for the climate. It's like chasing chimeras, a beast from Greek mythology, which sounds fabulous, but ends up to be a fanciful illusion.
Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a new documentary by veteran producer Barbara Bernstein, premieres on Locus Focus Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m. Tune into Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or 91.9 FM Hood River, or anywhere in the world streaming online at kboo.fm. That's Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Good morning and welcome to That Vegan Show. Today, our guest is Amanda Lawler. She is the founder and president of Bat World Sanctuary. Thanks so much for being here today, Amanda. I'm really excited to learn more about bats. It's not something I know a lot about.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this.
Well, honestly, I never thought that this is what I would be doing
sure.
for the rest of my life. But when I was, it started in 1988 when my mother and I were running a furniture store, and I was walking downtown on my way to the bank to make a deposit and saw this little furry form laying on the sidewalk and then realized it was a bat. And she was on her back, all fours in the air, and so hot, and she was just basically baking alive on that hot sidewalk, and I couldn't stand to see her suffer. But at the time, I believed, like most people did, that all bats are rabid, and they're, you know, nothing but vermin, and basically the same as trying to save a roach. But I could not stand to see her suffer, so I scooted her onto a newspaper with the toe of my shoe and took her back to our furniture store and put her in the storeroom, thinking, well, you know, she's probably dying of rabies, so I'll just at least try to make her comfortable. So I put a little tiny bit of water in there and an apple. I had no idea what they ate, a piece of an apple. And then I just kept going back and looking at her. She was just so fascinating. And just, she'd look back at me, and I'm like, wow, you know, there's something going on in that tiny little brain. So I went to the library and checked out a book. Back then, the internet didn't exist. So the only thing I had was a library, and I went through several books. Most of them said basically what I thought: all bats are rabid, they should all be killed, blah, blah, blah. But I finally found one book that had a lot of good things to say about bats, and I took the book home in hopes I could heal the little bat's wing and set her free, because I could tell her wing was injured. But that book taught me that basically bats are just enormously important, and if it, you know, they're literal insect-eating bats. Are so tiny, but they're literal vacuum cleaners of the night sky. They just do such a good job for us. And because of all the myths and misconceptions about bats over the decades, we've basically succeeded in almost killing off one of the best things we have as far as insect control. So my goal was to heal her wing and set her free, but her injury ended up being permanent. So she lived with me for the next year and a half and basically taught me, I fell in love, and she basically taught me everything in the beginning that I needed to know about bat behavior and care and things like that. I named her Sunshine because she was the opposite of everything I thought I knew about bats. Over the next year and a half, I just kind of just went, became obsessed with bats, and ended up founding Bat World Sanctuary in her name in 1994. Bat World is her legacy. And since then, we have just succeeded, and well, we've got rescue centers worldwide now. We've saved tens of thousands of bats every year around the world, and we have a sanctuary for non-releasable bats, as well as a rehabilitation center for bats that have been injured in the wild, where we rehabilitate and release them whenever we can.
Wow, that's an amazing story, and you know how your compassion for this little animal led to what you ended up, you know, realizing you were doing with your life.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you kind of sometimes you wander around aimlessly, not knowing what you're supposed to be doing with your life. And I was at that position, thinking, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? And then when I found this little bat, that just altered the course of everything I was doing. And so that is what I did. I followed that course, and it was the best decision I ever made.
That's something I was wondering about. Are there vets that can help with bats? Do they know about that?
Actually, well, now it's getting better. But when I started, the first vet I went to wanted me to, you know, euthanize her. Like, he just, literally, I walked in the door with her, and I said, you know, she's got an injured wing, and he just started backing up in the hallway. He didn't want to have anything to do with her. And, you know, I was surprised they didn't shove me out the door and lock the door. I mean, that's how bad it was. So the way that it worked with that same vet, actually, who is wonderful now, he's been our veterinarian for 30 years, I wrote a book about my experience with Sunshine and was lucky enough to get it published, and I gave him a copy. And after he read it, he was like gung-ho to help me with that. So we started working together on medications and remedies and, you know, therapies to try to help with bats, because before Sunshine came along, very, very little was known about bat rehabilitation. There was one book that was out there, and it basically, the instructions it gave was, well, if you treat pneumonia in a bat the same way you would a cat or a dog, well, how do you do that?
Right.
But that was basically that it gave you. So I knew we needed to get more information out there. So over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, I started working with another bat rehabilitator and teaching her my methods, and then we worked together on a book. And now the book is published by Bat World Sanctuary. It's called Captive Care and Medical Reference for the Rehabilitation of Insectivorous Bats. And so that book is now being used by veterinarians and biologists and everyone else and rehabilitators to rehabilitate bats. So it took an effort with a veterinarian, getting all these medications and therapies and remedies, and it also took information or just knowledge on bat behavior, and you know, what does this mean when they wiggle their ears or when they squint their eyes and things like that. So we, you know, over the course of all those years, I developed treatments and ways to see what pain was or see what a head injury was, or I mean, besides obvious injuries, you don't know what a back injury is on a micro bat, because they weigh less than a stick of gum, basically. So treating a lot of those injuries is almost impossible, but you can recognize the signs of those and start to treat them based on the signs. And so it took a long, long time to develop all that, but over the course of the last 30 years, we've got it all pretty much down pat. But that being said, there are more bat rehabilitators coming along. They're doing a phenomenal job working with their veterinarians and basically just taking the torch and running with it on what little Sunshine and I did initially. And I couldn't be more proud of that, just to see all the progress and all the openness now in the veterinary community with how bats are treated, insectivorous bats are treated across the U.S. It's really a great thing to see.
Yeah, it's really interesting how people have a perception. We did a interview about opossums, and people have, you know, kind of a similar perception. Oh, they have rabies, they have this.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to dispel some of those myths on this show for people, in case they do encounter a bat in their life and need to help it.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that if you're ready. One of the things that people believe is that all bats are blind, but they're not. They can see just about as well as we can. They actually have eyes that are equipped for night vision, much like a cat. So they can not only see, with their eyes, they also use echolocation, which is another fantastic thing that we could only hope to have. When an insect bat is just basically flying around at night trying to find an insect, it's not using its eyes anymore. It has eyes that, even though they can see better in the dark than we can, they still can't find a bug. So yeah, that's where their echolocation comes in to play. And they have their echolocation abilities are so incredible that they could find a human hair in total darkness and avoid it. So that brings us to the other myth, is that they don't get caught in people's hair. That's, I don't know where that even came from. It's like, so ridiculous. I mean, you could take a bat and wind your hair around it trying to get it tangled and it would work its way out. So they're great little guys on, getting out of just about anything as far as that goes. They're also not rabid. They're not all rabid, I should say. Bats are not asymptomatic carriers, meaning they don't all have rabies. A bat can contract rabies just like any other animal, but they actually come in very low on the list of animals. In Texas, for instance, they're fifth on the list of animals that might contract rabies, and that's after skunks, raccoons, foxes, and coyotes, and then finally bats. Less than 0.5% of all bats in the wild are going to contract rabies, so that's less than 1 out of 1,000. But that being said, if you find a bat on the ground, that bat is more likely to be sick than any other, than anything else. It could be sick, it could be grounded from a thunderstorm, it could be a baby bat learning how to fly, it could be a bat that's migrating and just run out of steam and can't go on anymore, it could be a bat that's been attacked by a blue jay and driven from a tree. There's 95 reasons out of 100 that it's something other than rabies, but because the bat could potentially be sick, then we never want anyone to touch a bat or any wild animal actually with bare hands. The best way to save that bat is to use a cloth or a glove, scoop him into a box. Even if you have a paper cup handy or a dustpan or anything, just gently scoop the bat up, place him into a box with the lid, and then give us a call at Bat World. And we have worldwide rescuers, and we will do our best to find help close to you. The other misconception is that all bats are vampires, which of course they're not. There are over 1,400 at this count. The count changes every year, but right now there are 1,400 different species of bats in the world. 70% of those eat fruit and nectar. The other 30%, most of them, eat insects. Out of all of those 1,400, only 3 species are vampires. They are all limited to Latin America, and they don't attack people. A vampire bat is about the size of a package of M&Ms, small package, and they're very, very shy. You could stomp your foot and a vampire bat would fly away. So unfortunately, they're made to look very grotesque, and all bats are vampires. They all suck your blood, they go for your neck, yada yada, but none of that is true. Vampire bats, even if you want to go a little further with them, they don't even kill their prey. Carnivorous animals will kill their prey. Vampire bat will drink about a teaspoon of blood from an animal, and they have an anticoagulant in their saliva, and they also have a heat detector in their nose. So they'll find a blood area that's the closest to the skin surface. They'll lick that area to deaden it, basically anesthetize that area. Then they make a little sharp incision with their teeth, and then they lap the blood, and they'll lap about a teaspoon. The only issue with that is that once they identify an animal, maybe numerous colony members will go and get blood from the same animal, and so it could weaken that animal over time. But if vampires are like, unfortunately, they're like the parasites of the bat world, but they don't kill, which a lot of animals do. Vampires don't intentionally kill their prey. Vampire bats are also altruistic, and if they have a sick or an injured colony member back in the cave, they will actually go back and share their food. It's kind of gross, but they will vomit their food so that the other colony member will have something to eat, and that's not seen very often in the animal world. Everything has to survive in some way, and I just think it's fascinating that they're altruistic like that. And if I could share a story along those same lines.
Sure.
One of the bats that I had hand-raised as an orphan and then released was found by one of our supporters in our local town, and he taught me a lot. His name is Little E. And what I, let me back up one more time. I bought a building back when I founded Bat World Sanctuary. I also bought a building that housed about 20,000 Mexican free-tail bats. It was an old sandstone building, and the owner wanted to kill the colony so he could sell the building. So I just bought the building to protect the colony. Over the next 20 years, that colony grew to about 100,000 because I cleaned it up. I made all kinds of amenities. I made it just perfect for them, safe for them, and every day I'd go up and rescue bats. And so one of the orphans that I rescued was Little E. And what when I wanted to prove that hand-raised orphans could be released, so I tattooed his ear with a little green marker and released the first batch of orphans one year, because everyone had said you can't release them once they're hand-raised, that their mothers teach them how to eat insects, yada yada. But I always watched them in the wild sanctuary, and I'm like, there's no way they could fly and learn how to catch insects from their mother. That's just physically impossible. In addition, they echolocate already. It's like a puppy. It's like, you don't teach a puppy how to bark. Well, you don't teach a bat how to echolocate. You don't teach a puppy how to run. You don't teach a bat how to fly. So my theory was, well, if they use those two things, if they can fly and echolocate, why wouldn't they use those skills to find insects? So I hand-raised orphans. I released them back to the wild. And Little E was found clinging to the side of one of our supporters' homes about 10 miles from where he was released. And I knew it was him immediately because his wings were a little bit shorter than they should have been. And I had seen this in the wild sanctuary as well, but none of those, it didn't ever seem to bother the bats. Well, when I found Little E, there was another bat right by him. He's actually on top, well, hit his little wing over Little E's body. So he was like hugging him and trying to tell him it would be okay. Mm-hmm. And then when we were to get Little E to rescue him, the other bat flew away. So the other bat was absolutely fine. He was only there 2 feet off the ground, hanging on the side of a building, giving Little E company. But then, of course, when he felt like it was like his life was in danger, he flew away. And so that really taught me a lot about their behavior and their emotions and how they feel about each other. And so, but at any rate, Little E was brought back. He was given permanent sanctuary and lived with me for years, and watched him fly. And that's when I realized that at some times, and it's just a birth anomaly, their little wings don't grow as long as they should. And if they're not as long as they should be, then they can't forage sufficiently to find insects. And Little E was very thin. So he taught me a big lesson, which I was then able to incorporate into the book and share with worldwide with everyone else. So little things like that can really make a difference if you just basically watch them and follow their lead. But yeah, that's another story about, you know, about their emotions and how they feel about each other, bringing vampire bats and insectivorous bats kind of together in that same light.
It's interesting how certain bats really inspired you to learn more about bats and share that information and keep helping them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best things I've learned is to follow their lead, because they can teach you, if you have your mind open and you're watching them, follow their lead, watch what they do, and that will kind of give you an idea of how you can help in different ways. And that goes for any animal. Just follow their lead.
Is your book on any other platform besides your website?
No, it's not. We could sell it to Amazon, but you know, they take such a cut. We don't do that. We sell it at cost anyway, so selling it on Amazon would actually put a deficit in our pocket.
I see.
But we sell it at cost. We only charge for shipping. That way, rehabbers can have access to it.
Okay.
Without it costing them. There's also a free download, and you know, if somebody can't afford a book, then they can get it free. Download it for free.
Okay, and what is your website if people wanted to get more information?
It's batworld.org, O-R-G.
Okay, that's pretty easy to remember. It's so exciting to hear that, you know, you've inspired so many people to keep looking into this and treat bats and not be afraid of them.
They're fascinating. They really are. And I mean, a lot of people who who first get into it, you know, just out of curiosity, and then they end up basically they're addicting. Once you start rehabilitating and working with bats, it's really hard to stop because they're just so they're amazing. They're like a monkey and an elephant and a cat and a dog all rolled into one because they've got so many. You just see so many things. The closest thing I could describe them are monkeys with wings, because they're so highly intelligent and they're just so and they're clean like cats. They groom their bodies constantly. Their fur is silky and soft, just like a cat. They have a huge memory. They remember people. They pick up on emotions with people. In fact, as far as intelligence goes, I've done behavioral studies on pre-tailed bats, which was the kind Sunshine was, and discovered 25 different vocalizations they used to communicate. And that's, I mean, they have an emotion or a sound for play, a sound, you know, the boys sing a song to the girls, so it's a little romantic. They have an irritation button. They have, you know, a mother has the pups have an isolation call, mothers have a directional call, so they can find each other. And even when there's millions of babies on a cave wall, a mother will be able to hone in on her own baby by the sound of his voice and by his smell. So they're just amazing. Their intelligence level is comparable to dolphins.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's they're extremely well. Actually, there was another study done at the University of Austin in Texas, and the professor there found that pre-tailed bats actually use syntax, which, you know, means they can put their chirps and buzzes and squeaks together to actually form sentences. And the only other animals that can do that, besides us and dolphins, are now bats. So I haven't read up on it. There may be another one, but that shows you just how intelligent they are. They're right up there with dolphins.
Wow. How long do bats usually live?
They're incredibly long-lived, depending on the species. Insectivorous bats can live anywhere from up to 42 years, and fruit bats can live. We had the longest lived bat here, a fruit bat named Statler. He was 34 when he passed away. But the longest lived insectivorous bat found was a Brandt's myotis, which is he was banded and then found 42 years later still going strong. So, and they don't even know how old he was when he was banded or how old he may be to this day. But he was 42 years, they have a record of him being alive for 42 years, which is incredible for an animal that's less than 2 inches long.
Right, I would have never thought that.
Yeah, and bats only have one live young per year, most of them, most species. Their tree bats have more. They're preyed on more by blue jays and crows, and so that's probably one of the reasons that nature gives them more. They have sometimes 4 to 5 babies only one time a year, but most of our North American bats have one baby, occasionally twins. So they're very slow reproducing, they're exceptionally long-lived, and that's one of the reasons that they're disappearing so quickly, is they don't bounce back in numbers quickly like other animals do. They don't have litters and you know, and reproduce 2-3 times a year. It's once a year, and one baby. So if they can live, let's just say on average they live 20 years, and someone finds a colony of bats behind their shutters, and they kill, say, 20 bats that could have lived 20 years. They just wiped out 400 years of animal life. So they're becoming endangered. Over half the bats in the U.S. are either on the endangered list or official candidates for the list. So we really do need to save each and every one.
How is there a safe? I assume there's a safe way to like relocate bats rather than kill them in that incident, like you were saying, if they're taking over someone's shed or property. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. We have what's called humane exclusion guidelines on our website. And so if it's a healthy colony and they don't need to be collected by a bat rescuer and rehabilitated, they can just be humanely excluded. And it's basically a way of making a one-way door so the bats can leave, but then they can't get back in. We always recommend putting up a bat house or something out like that close by, so the bats can have an alternate roost to go into, and then of course the bats would stick around and give the homeowner insect control, and while they've been moved out of the shutters where somebody may not want them, or under a porch or something like that. but there's always a humane way to evict an animal, no matter what wild animal it is. There's a humane way to deal with it.
Okay. So do bats eat just any kind of insects, or is there certain ones they prefer?
That's a good question. There's different species of bats prefer different bugs. Mexican free-tail bats prefer corn borer moths. That's their favorite. That's their go-to. And corn borer moths are a huge predator of our crops. They do an immense amount of damage to our crops. And free-tails are so beneficial that they eat tons and tons of corn borer moths every summer. And if we didn't have those bats to eat those moths, the ones that we don't kill with pesticides, if we didn't have them, we'd drive up our cost of pesticides, to drive up our health issues because of the pesticide use, and we'd end up paying $9 for an ear of corn in the grocery store. And of course, you find corn in everything, corn syrup, corn solids, corn powder, it's everywhere. So almost everything we use has corn in it. So the fact that these bats eat so many corn borer moths is just, it's an incredible advantage for us. Other bats, like big brown bats that are found mostly in the in the northern part of the U.S., their specialty is cucumber beetles. And they, a small colony of bats could eat, or one bat could eat thousands of cucumber beetles a night. In fact, one small bat can eat anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 insects a night, and that includes corn borer moths, beetles, gnats, aphids, leafhoppers. Any kind of insect that's going to hurt a garden is basically what bats are after. Of course, they also eat mosquitoes, which is a big help for us and also helps control disease. There's another bat called a pallid bat. It's a beautiful little bat with golden color, super long ears, and they prey on centipedes and scorpions. And in fact, their echolocation is so highly adaptive that when they're flying 100 feet up in the night sky, they can hear a scorpion walking on sand down below. And they're immune to the sting of a scorpion and a centipede. So they all have their different roles, and they all have basically different facial adaptations, so they all look incredibly different from each other. And each one of those adaptations, even in their ears, and the lines in their ears and the nodules and things in their ears, those are adapted for the specific insects they eat.
Yeah, you over the years we're hearing more about, how if bees go extinct, we're going to be in trouble agriculturally, and it sounds like we need to be getting that message about bats also.
Oh, definitely. Bats are, a lot of people don't realize how much bats control and how much they give us. Bats make up a quarter of all animals on Earth. And each of those animals has, this is one small instance. There's a bat in the tropics, in Africa, and they pollinate a tree called the baobab tree. Mm-hmm. That tree, it's also called the tree of life, because that tree provides food and shelter for over 400 different plants and animals. So if that bat disappears and the tree disappears, 400 other plants and animals are also going to disappear. And there's no telling what relies on those animals for survival. So everything is connected, and bats are a huge part of it. So if bats make up a quarter of all mammal species on Earth, and those animals disappear, then we're in trouble. Because that's a lot of animals controlling a lot of things that we do, a lot of things that we need. Fruit bats in particular, 98% of all rainforest regrowth comes from seeds that have been spread by fruit bats. 98%. So we're busy tearing down the rainforest right and left, and fruit bats are busy building it back up. And if we didn't have those fruit bats, the rainforest wouldn't grow back. But there's no way we could do 98% of it. The other thing is that they bring us an enormous amount of products. Over 400 different commercial products and 80 different medicines come from seeds that have been spread by fruit bats. And we're talking bananas. Even bananas, we can raise bananas, but they have to be mixed with wild stock in order to be sweet. And wild stock comes from bats. Bats pollinate banana trees. Chocolate, cocoa, cosmetics, coconut oil. There's so many things. Vanilla, mangoes, figs. I could just go on and on about all the different products that they bring us, and not to mention medicines. And that's 400 commercial products and 80 medicines is actually an old number. I'm sure that's probably been upped over the past couple of decades to quite a bit more. So we would be absolutely lost without bats. We wouldn't be able to go outside at night without wearing a spacesuit to protect ourselves from insects. We wouldn't have near what we have in the grocery store, even the hardware store. Sisal for rope, bamboo, carpet, paper, ink, all of those things have products or ingredients in it that come from bats. And speaking of all that, if I could give our cookbook a blurb, we have a cookbook called Bats in the Pantry. And in that cookbook, and it's a vegan cookbook, it lists ingredients and recipes where most of the ingredients come from bats in one form or the other, either by the crops they protect or by the plants they pollinate or the seeds they disperse. And there's information in the cookbook on how exactly a bat is linked with this particular product. So that's available on our website at batworld.org.
What's the name of it again?
Bats in the Pantry.
I'd love to hear an example of one of the recipes in the cookbook.
Okay, as an example, we've got pumpkin peanut soup that calls for carrots, celery, garlic, flour, peanut butter, pumpkin, coriander, ginger, and other spices. And if you go to the index in the back, it'll tell you how bats give us certain things. Let's say, for instance, we've got carrots, if I can find it for you really quick. On carrots with bats, if bats aren't around eating the eating root flies, rust flies, carrot beetles, and leaf hoppers and armyworms, we wouldn't be able to really have the carrots that we have without using tons of pesticides. Another ingredient that's one of my favorites is allspice. Allspice is brought to us by Jamaican fruit bats, and they eat the berries of the allspice tree and spread the seeds over hundreds of miles as they fly. And the sale of allspice brings in about $1 million annually to Jamaica's economy. And of course, we use allspice in everything from drinks to dishes to sides to desserts, pumpkin pie, etc. So that's just one small example of the many things that bats bring us just by existing.
Yeah, I really am learning so much. I didn't realize how impactful they were for agriculture.
Oh, tremendously impactful. In fact, when writing the book, it even opened my eyes, even though I've been doing this for years and years, it opened my eyes too on just how much they actually bring us or protect us from as far as insects go.
I guess I'm wondering, like sometimes we hear about orangutans or, some types of abuses, like with coconuts. I hope there's not, but is there anything like that with bats? Is my question making sense? Yeah, like of mistreatment of bats, trying to help. Okay. Darn it, I was hoping you were going to say no.
Yeah, I was too. Yeah, food bats are, unfortunately, they're just so abused in research and the pet trade. We have, in the fruit bats that we rescue, we can't release back to the wild because they're not from here. They're not from the U.S. Fruit bats are not native to the U.S., so we can't get them back to the country where they came from. Not only would the red tape be involved, would be tremendous, they wouldn't survive the flight or to get them back. And even if we could get them back, they don't have the survival skills because they've been in captivity for decades and they've been born and bred in captivity for so long, being sold into the pet trade and zoo surplus and things like that. We rescue bats from research, zoos, the pet trade, and situations like that all the time. And those are all fruit bats. So the majority of the bats we have here are fruit bats because they do live such a long time. We have over 400 bats here right now. And because they live so long, it's not something, they're not going to die in a year. They're here for decades, and so the population just keeps growing. Some of the bats that we rescued initially back in the late 90s are still with us, and so they're very old and they're geriatric. So we created what we call our geriatric ward, where all of the oldsters live. In basically a little rest home because they fall a lot, so they have hammocks that they roost in. They have Their fruit is close by. Their water and juice is close by. They're medicated every day with arthritis medication. Those that need little sponge baths get that. And they're happy. They have a beautiful little life in their geriatric ward. It's also in the flight enclosure where they once lived. So they haven't left their colony. They're just in a small section of it, and it's up high. It's against the ceiling, so they still feel like they're with the colony way up high with everybody else. And they can still communicate with everybody through the screen. But this keeps them safe and keeps them happy. And, you know, they don't have to compete for food or anything like that. It's just all right there in front of them. One of our bats, Statler, who his little video went viral, we would get him out every day and hold him under his chest and hold him up high, and he would flap his wings very slowly like he's still flying. And that video went viral. It was on the Dodo, and I think it had like 40 million views. So yeah, he's one of our, brought a lot of attention to Bat World. But his name's Statler, if anybody wanted to look him up. And then there's also Little Drac, who is another short-tailed fruit bat, who's very tiny, and his little video went viral as well. And both of those are on YouTube. Little Drac is a micro bat, even though he's a fruit bat. So fruit bats come in two sizes, basically micro and mega, and all sizes in between. They're kind of like dogs. If you look at the size of a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane, that's the same thing as a micro bat and a mega bat. They're all bats, but they come in different sizes. And insectivorous bats are all micro bats. They're all very small.
Okay. I guess I was wondering if you could tell us, like, different bats in different parts of the country. Like, I'm living in Portland now, but I'm originally from St. Louis. I remember my son, I wasn't with him. My son saw a bat one time when he was outside. So, yeah, I was just kind of curious, like, does the United States have similar bats? Or since we're so big, do they have different bats in different regions?
Yeah, it's basically different bats in different regions, but down in the, if you were to divide the United States in half lengthwise, the lower half, the most common species would be Mexican free-tail bats, which is what Sunshine was. The upper half, the most common species would be big brown bats. But that being said, we have species that exist in some states that don't exist in the other. Red bats, there's another bat, that bat is found throughout the United States, north and south. Also hoary bats, which are tree bats. Red bats and hoary bats are both tree bats, and they roost in trees. They're solitary. They don't live in a colony. And they're camouflaged to look a lot like a dried leaf or the bark of a tree. They're very beautiful. In fact, red bats are the same shades as a fall leaf. They're kind of oranges and, you know, reds and oranges and yellows and browns and all mixed together, and they can hang by one leg on the branch of a tree, and they fold their wings around them, and they look exactly like a dried leaf hanging from a stem. So that's just their camouflage. And then most of the other bats are crevice bats, and they're more drab colored, and because that also helps them to blend in with the caves and cracks and crevices that they roost in, so they kind of blend in wherever they are. That's one of the ways that bats have to protect themselves, is by camouflage, because they're not aggressive. They don't try to fight. They don't go after people. They just try to get away, and so they rely on their camouflage and their ability to fly and hang upside down to get away quickly.
Okay. So you're saying you have the sanctuary in Texas that has over 400 bats. Are there other sanctuaries for bats where they live in different parts of the United States?
Well, there are rescue centers or rehabilitation centers. Mm-hmm. We're the only accredited bat sanctuary on Earth, but we also have trained over 500 people across the U.S., bat rehabilitators, probably going on 600 now. And we help all of those rescuers as much as we can with supplies and knowledge and, you know, anything we can. Anytime there's an update with medications or new knowledge, we put that on our website so everybody can have access to it. But there's not another full-blown sanctuary like what we have here to rescue fruit and insect bats at the same time. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of money. Our bill for the fruit bats is $1,000 a week. And you know, it's a lot. It's a lot of awful lot of work. There's a lot of cleaning involved. So it would be a lot for a rescuer to try to take on. As far as true sanctuaries go, you know, there are groups out there that have fruit bats, and they use them for educational programs, which is highly stressful to those animals. There are, there are big, large crowds that are screaming and yelling, and the bats are frightened to death, and their lifespan is cut short by all that stress, and so that's something we don't do. Unfortunately, because bats are in the pet trade, it's easy for people to get a hold of bats like that. And the sad thing is they'll pay, I don't know, $1,000, $1,500 for a bat, and it usually is going to die within the first year. They have a lifespan of, like we've talked about, 20, 30 years in captivity, and it's cut short because people don't know how to take care of them. They're highly social. It's just a very sad situation. So that's one of the reasons we end up with so many from the pet trade as well, is they're relinquished to us after people realize they haven't done the right thing by wanting a cool bat as a pet.
Is it even legal to have bats, or is this the kind of the underground pet trade kind of thing?
Unfortunately, it's legal in some states, not every state. We do our best to curtail stuff, you know, when we find it, and you know, since because it is legal, all we basically can do is shame those people into trying, or those businesses into trying to do the right thing, but that doesn't always work. But yeah, it's legal, and that's something I've been working on with USDA for a while. But as anyone who's ever had any experience with working with USDA, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, and a lot of times it's just deaf, you know, it's just deaf ears. You just want to help one animal or one species, and sometimes it just all falls on deaf ears.
So it's a state-by-state kind of thing if it's legal to have a bat as a pet?
Pretty much, yeah. And then, of course, most people who do buy a bat as a pet realize quickly that it's a lot more work, a lot more mess, a lot more everything than it is, you know, and this is fruit bats. It's illegal to keep insectivorous bats as pets. Fruit bats, it's not. And so when people get a fruit bat, they don't realize that bat's going to need a flight area. That bat's going to make a mess. They're like flying juicers, basically, and fruit goes through their system in about 20 minutes, and it's like chickens. You've got a mess to take care of, except you've got a mess that ends up on the walls because they can fly. And keeping them in a bird cage is nothing but animal cruelty. So, people soon realize that they're out of their hands with it, or, you know, out of their element, and it's a lot more work and mess than they realize. And on top of that, they've got a very depressed animal who's going to die within a year if they don't have roostmates. And even if they do have roostmates, they need to have at least 20 or 30 and a flight area that's at least 30 by 30 feet big, so that there's enough room for everybody to fly and exercise. So it's an impossible situation keeping a bat as a pet. The only way to do it successfully would be to have 20 or 30 bats in a huge flight area that you'd have to devote 8 to 10 hours a day taking care of. So it's just not good. And sadly, the zoos are the most responsible for getting bats into the pet trade. Zoos are horrible when it comes to that. They let them breed uncontrollably. They leak them into the pet trade, either sell them or they will, you know, engage in mass culling. Instead of separating the species and neutering like they should, they just let them breed because, as one zookeeper told me, well, the public likes to see babies. So as long as that's going to happen and people are paying to go see babies, you're going to have bats that are being killed just because they exist and because they're overpopulating in zoos.
Wow. I'm just absorbing everything here.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot, and I'm sorry to bring that negativity to the show.
We're
working as we can to, you know, to do something about it with USDA. In fact, I gave a presentation to USDA about this same thing and about what happens to bats in zoos, and I've been jumping up and down and yelling about it for two decades, and people are starting to pay attention, but, you know, it just takes a long time to get that foot in the door. And I have a toe in the door, but that's about it right now. I'm not going to stop until I get my whole body in there, and bats have it better in zoos, because it's an impossible situation as long as they let them keep breeding. The last rescue we did was from a zoo in Colorado, and that involved 300 short-tailed fruit bats, 325 actually. The zookeeper, or the new head, contacted us, and bless his heart, he was trying to do the right thing because he stepped into a nightmare. And what they had done is the previous zoo official had placed all these bats, male and females, into a smallish flight area, probably 10 by 10, allowed them to breed uncontrollably until there were over 1,000. And so when this new keeper rolled in, he said, we have to do something about this. So he started separating everybody and trying to get control of the population. Well, short-tailed fruit bats can have delayed fertilization of up to a year. So they can decide when they want to have their babies. And if it's the right environment, they'll have their baby. And they can happen all the way up to a year. So you have to separate the females for an entire year to make sure they're not going to have a baby. And if they do have a baby, then you've got to make sure it's a female. If it's a male, you've got to watch so you can neuter him because they're going to start breeding almost, as soon as they can. And you're going to have the whole thing starting over. So needless to say, we worked with him trying to rescue as many as we could. We rescued 325 of them, and they were transported to us in a horrible situation. We're talking animals that are about the size of a hummingbird and about that delicate. And they put them in a crate a gorilla must have been meant for that crate, because they were in wire cages, hard wire cages, like very fine mesh wire, and those cages were placed inside a wooden crate that was screwed shut, and there was no way for anyone to check on those bats on the way to make sure they're okay. And this is a species that's highly stressed. Well, by the time they got here, they drove them from Colorado, 70 some odd of them were already deceased. Some of them were in the middle of aborting their babies. It was a horrible situation. The two girls who drove them here from the zoo were in tears after seeing the shape they were in. They were ice cold, and this is a tropical bat that should never get cold. And so, we documented all of this, sent it to USDA. The animal should have never been sent like that. So we ended up presenting to USDA on four different occasions over a bat symposium that they decided to bring about. And I was hoping it would do some good, but so far it has not done any good. Yeah, some people, they just can't be taught. And zoos are going to keep breeding and keep allowing this. And I threw them under the bus completely during my presentation and said, this is what happens, and showed photos and showed, what's going to happen if you don't, and neuter the males. Mm-hmm. You can't vasectomize, you can't spay, because it kills the girls. Oh. Vasectomies have been known to reverse in bats. You have to spay. And so I had videos on how to do all of this, how to control the population, especially the short tails, how to divide them and separate them, and, for a year or more to make sure that no boys are born. And then you get the population under control, and that's what we had to do with the survivors here. We had to keep them separated to make sure, because they had guaranteed us nobody was pregnant, but of course over 60 of them were. So, we had our own nightmare going on for about 2 years after that. And that's just one small zoo out of hundreds across the U.S. that just allow bats to mate like crazy, and they'll go in there with a net and just, catch a bunch of them and euthanize rather than try to even control a population. That's another zoo that I've heard about. Or they'll leak them into the pet trade.
And this is just the kind of message I want to get out there, because I know, certain vegans already are involved with protesting against zoos, and I think that, if they know about this too, that they may share your passion in trying to do something about it.
Yeah, the best thing that I can say, because we have so many people that have come forward to us that have seen bats in nature centers and just basically filled with roaches and mold, and we did rescue those bats, by the way. Mm-hmm. And just, horrible, horrible situations. And the best thing that anyone can do who sees that is to go to the manager, go to the media, go to anybody, and just raise Cain. Just say, this is what I saw. These animals deserve better. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Contact Bat World Sanctuary. They will freely give you any information. They'll give you enrichment items. They'll give you enclosure information on how to make their lives better. I can't tell you how many people we've done that for, to try, just because we can't rescue everybody. So we just want to make sure that the bats that are out there that we can't rescue at least have a better quality of life. Even in research, they deserve that. And that's just another horrible avenue that we probably shouldn't go down, because research is horrible when it comes to bats.
Yeah, I didn't realize they were doing research on bats, although I'm not surprised. And are they doing things because of their intelligence or more other kind of, I mean, if we could maybe just more touch on it.
Yeah, bats have been blamed for Ebola, you know, COVID, everything in the world. And the thing with bats, they have, their body temperature can raise to such an extreme when they fly that they burn off just about everything. Nothing can basically touch them. They're almost immune, to diseases. So when researchers go out there and they blame bats for, say, Ebola or something like that, they're going to find a bat. They're going to find, this bat has, is carrying Ebola. He's carrying the Ebola virus, even though he's not transmitting it. Or, they found that the bat had contracted it and burned it off. Well, that they immediately just blame a bat for all of those things. So almost everything that comes along, bats get blamed for. And so there's a lot of money in research. Their researchers are hot to trot when it comes to getting bats in and doing research on them simply because they're bats. Of course, their ability to fight viruses off. They do drug tests on their wing membranes because the skin on a bat's wing is very thin, basically just two layers of skin with the veins and capillaries that run in between. And so they do a lot of topical drug testing on bats that, and they're all euthanized at the end of research. They don't give them a chance to even get out and be released back to the wild or to a sanctuary or anything. They just euthanize.
Wow.
It's a very bad situation. In research and zoos, bats have no place being in either of those. It's just, no animal does.
Right.
We all know that. No animal deserves any of that.
Well, we know
and it.
And
it doesn't.
But it seems like a lot of other people don't.
I'm sorry?
I said we know that animals don't belong in research or zoos, but it's seeming like it's not moving fast enough.
And hopefully, in my lifetime, I would love to see that change. I'd love to see slaughterhouses shut down, everybody's healthier, animals treated the way they should, animals out of research. Most of that research doesn't benefit us anyway. We all know that anything tested on a bat isn't going to apply to a human. They've proven that a million times just with mice and other animals. So at some point, when the money isn't the target, because that's what it is. It's all about bringing money in. I found very little research that could help humans in the bat community. As an example, a researcher went into a cave and killed, hundreds of mothers and pups, pregnant mothers, and dissected them just to find the phosphorus level in the baby's bones as they were developing. So how does that help us? This is the kind of thing that it's maddening. And there's nothing anyone can do about it, unfortunately, because some of these people are just revered for their research when you don't realize the cruelty behind what they're doing.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show, Amanda, and sharing your passion and all of this knowledge and work that you've been doing for bats. I think it's a message that really needs to be spread far and wide.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you having us, and we can all help bats just by spreading the good word. Go to our website, follow our Facebook page. It's all linked on our website at batworld.org. And especially if you find a bat, please don't touch it. Please just scoop him into a box and then call us, and we'll do our best to get help.
Okay, so if they go to batworld.org, they can call you, and there's also educational information on there.
Yes, we have an educational link. And, I forgot to mention, we have five live bat cams that run 24/7.
Oh.
You can watch us clean during the day, and you can watch the bats play at night. They have toys, they have, food, they're flying, they're enjoying their lives. We also have a wildlife cam where you can see deer and rabbits and squirrels and birds. And then we also have goat cams because we rescue goats and sheep as well, so you can see those as well.
Okay, and I also wanted to mention again that there is a cookbook called Bats in the Pantry that is all vegan and tells you information about how the bats help with those particular foods. That's so I'm going to go look that up when we get finished here. I'm really interested in that. I have a background in nutrition also, so that's really intriguing to me. Seems like so many great things on your website.
Oh, thank you so much. The cookbook was really a lot of fun to put together.
Okay, well, thanks for listening to That Vegan Show today. We are on the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. every month on KBOO.FM.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
This is Bird Note. Each season ushers in its own bounty of bird life. Winter is the best season to highlight North America's feathered thunderbolts, the falcons. Northern nesting species of falcons, like this peregrine we're hearing, move southward, closer to their many admiring observers. Hurtling through the air on blade-like wings, falcons rank among the fastest of all birds and the most adept at capturing prey in flight. One falcon much more prevalent across the U.S. in winter is the merlin. 10 inches tall with a 2-foot wingspan, the merlin chases down small birds from sparrows to sandpipers. Small but powerful, the fearless merlin will buzz even a huge eagle that enters its airspace. The majestic gyrfalcon drifts south in winter to the northern tier of states. Larger than a red-tailed hawk, in a direct sprint, the gyrfalcon can overtake even the fastest duck. The mid-sized peregrine falcon nests in some locales across the country, but its numbers are greatest in winter, especially near the coasts. During its dive on a hapless pigeon or dunlin, a peregrine may reach an airspeed approaching 200 miles an hour. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more. طولك يا عود الريحان عيون عيون الغزلان دق لك الاسواق الاسواق نشرها عالرماني دق الماني دق الماني طولك يا عود الريحان عيون عيون الغزلاني دق الماني دق يا ويلو وين سقف الشيخ طبع وحلبة مجنون دق الماني دق الماني لبست أجمل بنطلون رامي بحبة مجنون دق الماني دق الماني تسلم لي نظرة العيون عيون عيون الغزلاني دق الماني يا خليو وين سافي وين سافي يلا عطبل عطبل وان Yamma 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 يلا اللي بيحب ابو الشوارع الحمراء يرفع ايده لفوق اسمع لك اللي بست اجمل تنوره سمره بحاله مغروره دق الماني دق الماني
الماني لبس الأجمل تنورة شعر بحالة مبرورة دك الماني دك الماني تسلم لي نظرة العيون عيون عيون الغزلاني دك وين الساف يا خيو يا قلبي لعيونك يا روي أحلى سيتيا
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news. You're listening to KBOO.